So when you hear words of the Buddha or the Buddha that's come down to us through the ages, just know that he's talking to you. So when he says, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, know that he's talking to you, your heart. This is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method for the realization of nibbana, namely the four satipatthanas. As my teacher says, satipatthanas. This is our birthright, our inheritance, freedom from sorrow, lamentation, dukkha, and discontent, nibbana, the highest happiness, profound peace. And admittedly, the road there isn't always happy, isn't always peaceful, bumpy. But by allowing ourselves to have an honest encounter with dukkha, we come into this inheritance, our birthright of freedom, through contemplating the four satipatthanas. Body. In that guided meditation, we were playing with the breath, just coming into knowing the body through what's sometimes called the preliminary in the first tetrad of the Anapanasati Sutta, mindfulness of in and out breathing. Oh, this first establishment, contemplating this first establishment of mindfulness, satipatthana, contemplating body, feeling tone, heart, mind, dhammas. You can think of dhammas as that which the study of what actually leads to study, like direct experience of what actually leads to awakening and what leads away from awakening. What obstructs the arising of wisdom and what opens the way to the arising of wisdom. You can also think of the dhammas as liberative frameworks and liberative. I just did a retreat where they talked about pointings, these teachings that are pointing to for us to understand our direct experience in service of freedom, in service of this birthright, our inheritance, what the heart longs for, just some peace. And the Buddha reminds us that these four satipatthanas, these four establishments of mindfulness, of body, feeling tone, heart, mind, dhammas, are our home turf, as Venerable Analia would say, or our native land. It's one way that Gill translates it, or Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as our ancestral domain. A synonym for domain is home. So I like the phrase ancestral home. Move in your own ancestral domain. I'm actually going to use the synonym home for domain. Move in your own ancestral home. And what practitioners? And what is a practitioner's ancestral home? Is the four establishments of mindfulness. we contemplate this Pali word, Anupasati, the four Satipatthanas. And this is really funny that this word Anupasati, Anupassati, is translated into English as contemplate. It has connotations of thinking and pondering and like intellectual activity. But we're not thinking about or pondering, say, the first establishment, the body. We're not thinking about the body. We're not pondering the body. This first establishment that we'll be exploring tonight, we'll be continuing to explore tonight. Not thinking about the body, not pondering the body. Another way that Anupasati has been translated is repeatedly looking at, closely observe. So we actually call on, like, through intention, we arouse mindfulness to just rest and receive the experience of the body. And the more I practice, the more that mindfulness is starting to feel like turning toward, and this turning toward is a real light touch of just a slight movement of intention. Like, may mindfulness arise. Or just sometimes that's too heavy and it's just mindfulness, sati. She's right there. I say she because that's my experience and how one of my teachers characterizes the quality of mindfulness. It's very this quality, this knowing presence that has archetypal qualities of femininity, openness, receptivity, just gathering information. He talks about it giving birth to a new perspective, a new way of being. More and more mindfulness is feeling like a turning toward, attuning to, and resonating with experience. So through sati, through mindfulness, through this turning toward, attuning to, resonating with the body, we're actually gifted with this opportunity to like observe closely, to see repeatedly, say the body. This first establishment of mindfulness, this first satipatthana. And through repeatedly seeing the body, revealed through these six practices of mindfulness of the breath, the body, the bodily postures, the bodily activities, practicing with the anatomical parts, contemplating the elemental nature of the body, contemplating cemetery contemplations, the heart mind comes to actually understand the true nature of body. We come to rest in this ancestral home. And we're gifted with this inheritance of freedom. Satipatthanas not only arouse mindfulness, help us to develop mindfulness, to establish mindfulness, but that seems so static. It's just that mindfulness is more and more present. There's this continuity, like you couldn't stop it if you wanted to once the conditions are there for this continuity. And then with the strength and power of that mindfulness, we can see into the nature of body. Not our ideas, not our wishes about the body, but the true nature of the body. So it's been a long time since we last saw each other. It's been about a month. And we got together the first time we started exploring three of the six practices was on February 14th, Valentine's Day. Great day to come into like a loving relationship with the body, like contemplating the anatomical parts. Yeah, so we just played with that the body isn't inherently sexually attractive or unattractive. We talked about the ways that we've been acculturated to view bodies, that we've received ideas that have been ingrained in us through repetition, and that we then project onto bodies or various parts of bodies certain meaning or associations that endow a person with a certain level of value. And through the anatomical parts practice, we learn to retract that projection, retract the projection of attractiveness or unattractiveness, valuable, unvaluable, our ideas around gender and race. And we come to have just a balanced view of and response to all bodies, our own, that of others. The next time we were together, which was February 28th, we looked at the elemental nature of the body, the fact that the body's empty of a solid entity of self. And this is revealed through seeing the elemental process nature of the body. The four great elements of earth, water, fire, and wind. You're really feeling into their life, their aliveness. That organically through this practice, we start to let go of taking birth of this rigid idea of ourselves or rigid ideas of ourselves that are constructed around this very live, influx, flowing dynamism of the body. It's like there's this flow, and then we fixate on this one moment, the snapshot, and we build a sense of self around that. The elements practice helps us to relax that habit and just drop into the direct felt experience of earth. And how earth actually starts to kind of shift. On the inhale in the chest, it feels really light. On the exhale, earth element in the chest feels heavy. We are aware of cohesiveness, flow in the limbs, the body, the varying temperature in the body, coolness in the tips of the fingers, warmth in the core of the torso, how that's shifted and kind of influenced by whether we have a blanket around the hands, where the hands are just exposed to the temperature in the room. And breath, movement in the body, tingling, pulsing. There's no entity in control of this. Just drop into that for a moment. Are you making tingling happen in your lips? Are you responsible for the sense of weight and firmness and heaviness in the thighs and the sits bones? Yeah, we can shape the inhale and the exhale, hold our breath. But then we forget about the breath and it's still breathing on its own. It's a process, biological process. So we explored this last time we were together. And tonight, We're going to explore the cemetery contemplations. Repeatedly seeing direct experience, not our ideas, not thinking about, directly felt sense of connecting with our own death and the death of our loved ones and death of all humans, all beings. It helps us to see and deconstruct our misperceptions of the body so that we can come into like a harmonious relationship, nurturing relationship with the body. So this, just yesterday, I had a lovely conversation with a friend. And he was talking about seeing his body, seeing, witnessing, being with his aging body. He said, you know, one manifestation of it is just that this body is losing its vitality very slowly, but it's starting, this vitality is starting to ebb. And can we come in contact with the truth of that? The fact of it, not deny it, and yet still care for the body as the vitality is waning. Now, with the cemetery contemplations, through repeatedly seeing, we connect with the body as mortal, ultimately impermanent. And when it dies, it'll return to the elements. It'll return to the elements and help sustain life. It's a very powerful contemplation. So sometimes this practice is referred to as the corpse in decay. And that can sound so morbid, but it's not a morbid practice. It's not a morbid reflection. Monastic, you probably all know this, but it's great to be reminded of it because it's so inspiring. Venerable Anallio, monastic and scholar, cemetery contemplation is his favorite. Satipatthana, I think it's his favorite practice. I've heard him say it's his favorite practice. I remember going for a walk with him and telling him that, and one of my defense mechanisms around the cemetery contemplation is that sometimes when I'm practicing, I'll start with anatomical parts, elements, and I will skip over, not knowing that I've done it, skip over the cemetery contemplation and move right into working with Vedana, feeling tone. He kind of looked at me askance. And I was motivated after that look to like really be curious, like, why are you skipping over this? Why are you jumping over this? Yeah, he keeps it at the forefront of his consciousness through having a skeleton in his kuti. He's been very open about the fact that he has a coffin that he sleeps in every night. And before he goes to bed, he goes through the stages of decay, which is what this cemetery contemplation is, just reflecting on these stages of decay. And he says that this practice has imbued him with a lot of joy. And you feel it in him. There's a lightness and a levity and a playfulness. And he's so dedicated, so dedicated. We can think that playfulness and joy are kind of mutually exclusive with someone who's like so dedicated to practice. But the more I get to know him and the more I spend time with people who have experienced some measure of freedom, you feel there. You feel the thinness of selfing. And what comes through can be a real lightness, playfulness. And he says that death has really clarified his values. I remember, I guess this was in 2019. Sitting with him And just talking with him after the retreat that he had taught, he had just taught the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing. And I said, how are you doing? And he said, I'm so happy. He said, I'm doing everything that I want to do. There's nothing that I'm not doing. And he says, it's because of the cemetery contemplation. It's really helped me get clear about what it is that's valuable to me. And I dedicate my time to that. So when we consider someone like Venerable's relationship with the cemetery contemplations, we see that this practice, in a way, he's invited death to get really close to him. And that this is possible for the human heart. This is possible for us. There's this really wonderful trilogy called His Dark Materials. It's by Philip Pullman. It's loosely based on Milton's Paradise Lost. It's a profound story, beloved by adults and children. I fell in love with this trilogy and read it probably 5 times between the age of 19 and 24. It culminated with me flying to England to see a staged version of this. It takes 36 hours to read the trilogy aloud. And they boiled the trilogy down to its essence in this play, into a 6-hour play. So it was divided into 2 nights. We went first night 3 hours, second night 3 hours. Very profound. And at the heart of this book are 2 children, Lyra Balakwa, or Lyra Silvertongue, and her friend Will Perry. And one part of the book, they're on their way to the land of the dead because Lyra wants to make amends with her friend Roger. And she didn't intend to harm him. She did not intend to kill him, but she recognizes that her actions led to his death, and she wants to go to the land of the dead to apologize to him. Heavy book for 10 and 11 year olds. I wish I had a book like this when I was that young. So although Will and Lyra are having a hard time finding passage to the land of the dead, they arrive in this Bardo-like place. And this Bardo place is filled with people of all ages, including an older woman, this grandmother named Magda. This is a passage from that book, from the trilogy. The children, flushed with tiredness, looked with sleepy eyes from one grown-up to the other, but no one could suggest where they could find a boat. Again, they're trying to get to the land of the dead. Then came a voice that hadn't spoken before. From the depths of the bedclothes in the corner came a dry, cracked, nasal tone. Not a woman's voice, not a living voice. It was the voice of the grandmother's death. The only way you'll cross the lake and go to the land of the dead, he said. And he was leaning on his elbow, pointing with a skinny finger at Lyra, is with your own deaths. You must call upon your own deaths. I've heard of people like you who keep their deaths at bay. You don't like them. And out of courtesy, they stay out of sight. But they're never far off. Whenever you turn your head, your deaths dodge behind you. When you look, they hide. They can hide in a teacup, or in a dewdrop, or in a breath of wind. Not like me and old Magda here, he said, and he pinched her with her cheek and she pushed his hand away. We live together in kindness and friendship. That's the answer. That's it. That's what you've got to do. Say welcome, make friends, be kind, invite your deaths to come close to you. Say welcome, make friends, be kind, invite your deaths to come to you. We are so afraid of death in this culture. We hide death away. And coming to the East Coast, it's been a shock, and it's still a shock to see cemeteries next to playgrounds or along an interstate, just in plain view. It's so different from where I was raised, where cemeteries are tucked away and you need to take this long, windy road into this rural area to get to the place to visit with your dear ones, your ancestors who have passed. We even try to slow the decaying process by embalming bodies, trying to slow this natural disintegration process of the body. There's this movement now for natural or green deaths. There's even a cemetery in Mill Valley where you can choose to have your body put in a shroud and just return to earth. Now, with the cemetery contemplations, we come face to face with death. We cease hiding from our own death, the death of our loved ones. We befriend death through imagining a corpse going through stages of decomposition. That's one way of practicing with this contemplation. You don't need to go through all the stages of decay. There's this really wonderful guided meditation on Dhamma Seed. It's so good. It takes you through not all 9 stages, but spirit of all the stages. And if you're not, if your mind is like, I don't want to go through any of the stages of decay, that's fine. You can actually do a guided meditation that uses the breath as a gateway to contemplating our own death. Now, the general practice is just to imagine a corpse in its various stages of decay, and we compare our own body to that of the imagined corpse. And the reflection from the Satipatthana that we drop into the heart mind when we're imagining the corpse decomposing is this body too is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. It could be as simple as this body is going to die. I've been lately saying this body is dying. While it's alive, it's moving towards death. It takes a lot of courage to face our own death and the death of the people that we love. Now, one of the reasons it can be so hard to face our own death is we're living with this deep, deep biological imperative to survive. And to face death is to acknowledge that this deep, DNA deep imperative is going to ultimately fail. And this is from the poet Lucille Clifton. It's called Mother Tongue, We Are Dying. We are dying. No failure in us that we can be hurt like this, that we can be torn. Death is a small stone from the mountain we were born to. We put it in a pocket and carry it with us to help us find our way home. No failure in us that we can be hurt like this, that we can be torn. Death is a small stone from the mountain we were born to. We put it in a pocket and carry it with us to help us find our way home. Returning to our earth has been so supportive in sustaining our lives. We're kind of a great ancestor that we return to home, but it doesn't feel like going home from the perspective of the ego. Just thinking about death can throw us into all kinds of reactivity. These defense mechanisms come up. In my experience with this practice, now that I'm not jumping over it as much as I used to, sometimes I actually catch myself moving to Vedana from the elements. I'm like, no, come back. Come back to that. It's so interesting because in the guided meditation, Venerable Lanalio has put in this beautiful bridge from the elements practice to the cemetery contemplation of the breath, using it as a gateway. Still, my mind's like, but I tend to notice now that I'm jumping over and come back. All these defense mechanisms. What I'm noticing, and this is just my opinion, that the practice is actually meant to bring forward all of our defense mechanisms so that they can be seen for what they are, just an energetic contraction. An energetic contraction in the heart mind that can actually be held and metabolized, that it starts to disband. And then what's left when the fact of death touches the heart is tenderness, compassion, a soberness. Like, how am I living my life? Am I doing right by people? Am I living in accordance with my values? Who do I need to make amends with? So I think this practice is meant to elicit the defense mechanisms, like flat out denial. Like the science of cryonics, this belief that just as long as the brain isn't damaged and remains intact, that the brain can be reanimated at some later time. We are clinically dead, but there's still this belief, if we keep the brain intact, that we can evade death. There's the defense mechanism of thinking that death is far off. I experienced this once at the Forest Refuge doing walking meditation, and I wanted to bring this cemetery contemplation into the walking. So death was at the end of the walking path, and as I was walking towards my death, it was walking away from me. It wasn't getting any closer. So just, it's far off. I'm going to die when I'm 90. I'm not going to die now. But the truth is, we don't know when death is going to come. My godfather died January 7th of this year. I was hoping that I would be in the Bay Area so I could say goodbye to him, but it didn't happen. We didn't know that he was going to die January 7th. We didn't know. Perhaps he knew. I don't know. But we don't know when death is going to come. All the more reason why to get clear with our priorities and live from our values. It's just the defense mechanism of ignoring our death. Venerable talks about this as ignoring our own death as trying to run away from our own shadow. Have you ever done that as a kid? Just trying to run from your own shadow. My care is like my shadow in the sun. Follows me flying, flies when I pursue it. I don't remember who that poet is. It was from the Elizabeth R. series that was on PBS like a million years ago with Glenda Jackson. Now, running away from our own deaths, trying to run away from our own shadow. Had an experience of this that was really singular, really left a mark on the heart. When my aunt was dying, it's just this biological process of her body shutting down at its own pace in its own time. So my mother and I are with her body. She's gone. I know that she's gone. And yet my mind is projecting breathing onto her body. I check. Body's not breathing. She's gone. I take my hand away. And again, it looks like she's breathing. And then you realize how rare it is for all of us living folks to see a body that isn't breathing. Like most of our days, most of our time, we're surrounded by breathing bodies, our pets, each other, deer, squirrels. Just this rhythmic, very subtle movement that the heart mind is actually tracking at some level. So here my mom and I are with my aunt's body. It isn't breathing, projecting breathing onto the body, checking, no, it's gone, no breath. And yet the thought arose, and I am not kidding you, the thought was, maybe she's still alive. And there it was, the denial. Maybe she's not dead. Maybe death hadn't taken a hold of her. And yet I had proof. And the heart was still resisting the truth of death, the finality of it. No arguing with it. We don't need to make an enemy of these defense mechanisms against death. We just allow the sting to be there. Now open to it, allow it. And metabolizing the sting of death. With our care, very steady attention is turning toward, attuning to, resonating with, mindful of, this repeatedly seeing truth of death. Oh, my reactivity, this sting. Slowly, gently, courageously acclimating to the truth of death. Just by being present to the sting alongside the truth that we're dying, we're moving toward death even as we live. In the Satipatthana Sutta, one of the stages is actually imagining the corpse being eaten by animals. And this stage can be really hard to imagine because we're still so identified with the body that we just don't like to think of our body as food for anybody. Like, we have a hard time with being bitten by mosquitoes and horseflies, let alone like all these creatures eating us. And the resistance that's sometimes felt as disgust and agitation. This part of the contemplation highlights the subtle and overt ways that we identify with the body. During a talk, Ayananda Bodhi shared her wish that her corpse be nourishment for other beings. such a radical thing to say in a Dharma hall, partly because we don't talk about or even really practice with the cemetery contemplations all that much, even in long retreat. I think it's because we underestimate our capacity to actually be at peace with death. We encounter our defense mechanisms, the fear beneath them, the panic, and we just run. But our heart minds have a deep and wide capacity for truth. There's a part of the heart mind that loves being in contact, being in harmony with truth, no matter how painful the truth might be. It's a part of us that like loves truth. The Ayananda Bodhi's wish that her body be eaten by animals is such a helpful reframe. Like seeing the body, once you're done with it, seeing the body as nourishment for other beings. Now, in this wish, there's still identification with the body, but there are times when the corpse contemplation, where it can start to feel like an offering that mitigates the aversion towards imagining living beings eating the corpse. And there's even a relaxing into being part of the cycle of the living, dying, and harvest cycle of life. This letting go into this part of the contemplation has also been supported by recognizing that the food that I eat was made possible in part by organic matter, decaying beings, leaves. So in a way, once living beings are now helping to sustain my life. And it only seems natural that I too would be part of that cycle of sustaining life through the process of decay when my body dies. In an interview on Being with Krista Tippett, Mary Oliver, who's now one of our ancestors, she put it this way. She said, we all wonder what will happen when we die. All that stuff, it's never nothing. I'm very fond of Lucretius. Lucretius says everything is a little energy. You go back and you're these little bits of energy and you're something else. It's something quite wonderful that the world, everything is pretty much mortal. It dies. But its parts don't die. Its parts become something else. We know that when we bury a dog in the garden with a rose bush on top of it. We know there's replenishment. That's pretty amazing. I'm just learning to rest in the ancestral home of the body. Aware that as we live, we are dying. We see that our time here is finite. How do we want to use our time and energy for this one precious life, to bring in Mary Oliver? How do we want to use our time for this one precious life that we have, that we've been gifted with? Make amends, forgive. I remember after my aunt died, my mom called me over for my birthday. And she handed me very ceremoniously this black folder. I opened it up and it was her will in her end of life wishes. And I just burst into tears and she said, we have to like name this now. because my aunt did not do this and it was a mess. So she's like, we got to tend to this now. And she was there with me as I was with the sting of, I don't want to lose my mama, but I will. Putting our affairs in order. You know, we can be of value, actually live from our values, and not be so imprisoned by our defense mechanisms of death. It's like we come into the truth of it. It's like, what I've got to lose? I'm laughing because I remember walking with Venerable and putting on my mask. And we were outside and he's like, take off your mask. I want to be able to see your face and communicate with you. It's like, but I don't want to, like, if I've been exposed to COVID, he's like, I'm ready for my death. Can you imagine that? Ready for your death. Ready for your death. What's that like? Amazing. Let's sit for a couple of minutes.